When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On today's podcast, Julian Bagini, the writer and philosopher whose new book is How to Think Like a Philosopher. For today's discussion, we're looking at politics and how real-world issues and the public discourse in general could potentially benefit from embracing a more philosophical perspective. Joining Julian in conversation today is Jesse Norman, the politician and author who was himself once an academic philosopher. Here's Jesse with more.
Well, thank you very much indeed, and what a delight it is to welcome an Intelligence Squared audience, and doubly so to this fabulous conversation with Julian Bagini. Julian is a man who's spoken to more philosophers and done more philosophy himself than most people walking the planet by a very long margin, and he's written this fabulous new book, How to Think Like a Philosopher, now available in all good bookshops and online. And if you wanted any one human being who spoke human as well as spoke philosophy to debate how we apply philosophy to politics or whether politics can benefit from philosophy, you would probably start and end with Julian. So what a delight it is to see you, Jules, and welcome to the program. And perhaps you can kick us off by giving us a bit of an intro into your book and possibly any implications for slow thinking or inadequately clear thinking politicians.
Thanks, Jesse. I have to say, it's very unusual to actually be pleased that the politician in the room is the person in charge of the conversation. But I'm delighted about that this evening. But you're no ordinary politician, of course. Well, look, thanks. I won't try and digest the whole book, but perhaps I can say something about the general thrust of it, which I think directly relates to good thinking in politics and public life. And that's that if you pick up most books on how to think, critical thinking texts, even philosophical textbooks, they tend to focus on what you might call matters of technique. So in particular, they'll tell you about formal logic. It may or may not use symbolic logic, but they'll certainly tell you about how to construct a deductive argument, which is sound and valid. And they'll run through different fallacies that you need to avoid, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all good things, and I cover a lot of them in the book. They're all very, very sensible. But it seems to me that there's a big thing missing from this. And that is that good thinking doesn't only require a command of these technical skills. It requires, to use a rather old-fashioned word, virtues. And what we mean by virtues here is not kind of, eating tofu and drinking sort of herbal tea. What we mean is it's those the good habits and practices which are conducive to good living both for yourself and for the rest of society. And there are virtues of thought. And of course, this isn't I don't ever claim to be an original thinker. I like to try and think I'm a synthesizer. I try and bring things together. Bernard Williams, who was a great philosopher from the late 20th century in England, his last book was called Truth and Truthfulness. And in that book, he talked about this. And he thought there were two key virtues of thinking, which were accuracy and sincerity. So what he means is this: if you're going to think well, you've got to, know the logical chops, that's all very well. But first of all, you've got to sort of be determined to be accurate. So if you're arguing from the facts, you've got to make sure you're getting those facts right, okay? You've got to make sure you're not just latching onto the facts that are convenient to you, ignoring the ones that aren't. You've also got to be accurate in the sense you've got to represent the arguments of people you are arguing against fairly and accurately, not caricature them, straw man them. And the sincerity thing is you've actually got to be really keen to genuinely get to the truth. And that may sound obvious, but of course, it's easier said than done, because most of us, when we come to any issue, if we're honest, what we're primarily interested in doing is supporting the conclusion that we already have and the one that makes us comfortable. So it's a real effort to engage with absolute sincerity. Now, this, you can see how this clearly relates to politics, I think, because politics is full of smart people. And I think it's a great mistake to sort of not to think that. I remember Peter Singer, quite a few years back now, he wrote a short book called The President of Good and Evil, I think, which is about George W. Bush. And in the first few pages, he says, it's very fashionable to say that George Bush is stupid. And he says, this is a mistake. You don't get to be the President of the United States by being stupid, right? You're underestimating him. You've got to take him seriously. And if you want to sort of like, you know, if you oppose him, as Singer did, you've got to understand him and take him seriously. So, but the point is that there are lots of very smart people in politics, but a lot of them, I think, struggle with sincerity and accuracy, right? We are getting people who will obviously, to score political points, they will cherry pick the statistics, the findings that they like. In order to make their opponents look stupid, they will caricature their positions and so forth. And again, sincerity, there are lots of things in the way of sincerity. And I really want, you know, your view on this, Jesse, because in a way, there are actually official ways in which you can't be sincere. If you take collective responsibility, you have a kind of responsibility as a politician to support your party line, especially if you're a backbencher, not so much, but even so to a certain degree. If you're in government, we have this convention where you have to support it. So in a way, you can't be sincere. You can't say, I've just come out of that meeting and I thought it was a stupid idea, but I'm going to go along with my my peers. So yeah, there are real problems with having that kind of properly intellectual conversation in politics. And I think that I'm aware from previous conversations I've had with, you know, people in politics that sometimes they think that people who come in from the outside philosophically talking about how we should do politics are basically just very naive, actually. And they have this unrealistic idea of how much we can expect and hope politics to be rational, fair, honest and sensible. I don't know what you make of that.
Well, what a fantastic way into the conversation, Julian. So let's do a little philosophy first and then pick up some of the political points or political questions that you raise. So I think it's very interesting and important to distinguish between what the rational or the logical tools that a philosopher has at their disposal, and then what you've described as the epistemic virtues with which those tools are being deployed. Because otherwise, and as you say, in politics, you do see this a bit, you get people, you know, constantly failing to give adequate weight to the other side or chopping. And of course, that itself can derive from a rather debased conception of the political process and indeed the electorate. Now, one of the joyous things about our politics is that at the end of the day, if you want to be an MP, you know, a majority of your constituents have to vote for you. And in many constituencies, they will know who you are and they will be paying a lot of attention to what you say. The idea that somehow the electorate is stupid or doesn't notice when, you know, people chop off an argument, give it halfway, don't listen to the other side, as it were, misrepresent what's being said, you know, it's absolutely deranged. The electorate, certainly in Herefordshire, and I think it's true everywhere else, is extremely smart about these things. And of course, it drives them mad when they see these virtues the way in which, you know, people normally in outside politics interact with each other, giving people the benefit of the doubt, hearing them out, you know, rationally reconstructing their position. You know, it drives them mad when they don't hear that being used in politics. And it fuels the idea that, you know, it's all really about pre-prepared answers to, as it were, questions that you wish you'd been asked rather than the one you actually do get asked. At the same time, I do think the politician can push back a little bit. Politician can say, look, what is politics? I mean, politics is an attempt to create a framework in which this country can be safely and peaceably governed. And so that's one way of thinking about politics. And it's extremely complicated. It's complicated in several different dimensions. So one is the fact that there are lots of different facts that might bear on a particular political position or judgment. A second is that there are lots of dynamic factors that mean that judgment may change over time as the facts change and draw different principles into play. And then I'll give an example of that in a moment. And then the third one, of course, is that politics is ultimately about trying to trade off things which are incommensurable with each other. So if someone says, look, we can either go for this policy which gives us 2% GDP growth or this policy gives us 2.5% GDP growth, most people will say, well, we'll talk to an economist and we'll probably go for the one with the more growth, right? If, on the other hand, it's a question about building the airport or protecting the wetlands, you know, you can have all the economists in the world telling how marvelous the airport is, and that's not going to persuade someone who's concerned about the wetlands, because they're not just thinking about economics, if they're thinking about economics at all, and vice versa. So you've got to have some process by which these incommensurable ways of thinking are taken out of their professional boxes and put into some democratic framework where those things can be traded off against each other. In that sense, it's a rather Burkean thought. A good politician, a good member of parliament, is kind of a philosopher in action. It's trying to think if they have the epistemic virtues you're describing, it's trying to think around the corners of how these different interests get traded off. And when we think about, I'll take another Burkean example just because it's quite useful. So people sometimes accused Burke of being inconsistent because he supported the American Revolution but was violently against the French Revolution. And so the thought is, well, hold on a second, you know, you seem to be in favor of one revolution and not in favor of another. That means you're a hopelessly inconsistent, you know, deceitful windbag. This claim was made about Burke during his lifetime. Of course, it takes the philosopher to say, well, actually, we mean slightly different things by revolution in each case. The American Revolution was a fundamentally conservative defense to protect a way of life from the arbitrary imposition of imperial power by Britain through the form of taxation. And the French Revolution was the opposition to French Revolution was a conservative defense of some form of society, not necessarily the Bourbon society of the time, but some virtues of society in the face of a totalitarian political attack. So those kinds of considerations are going to be echoing in politics as well. And the mistake of thinking that either all politicians are thuggish and brutish and deceitful, or indeed that the electorate won't notice, is, I think, that there are a cluster of different mistakes involved in those.
I mean, the interesting points, I think you made more than two, but I think there are two I just want to pick up on. The first one, I think, is this idea that people overstate the extent to which, you know, politicians are sort of deceitful, whatever, because people notice. And effectively, to say that, it sounds like a criticism of politicians. In effect, it's an insult on the electorate, because it's saying they can't spot these things. Now, I think there's some truth to that, but I think what we also know is, in a democracy, what really matters is often, especially these days, the swing voters. If you can swing enough people at the right time. So it may well be that 90% of the people are, you know, making their decisions on the basis of their thought out decisions. But that, you know, but all you need to do is to fool enough of the people enough of the time. And I just think that, you know, I don't think we can look at the record of probably any of the major political parties and say that, you know, they haven't used some rather devious techniques of rhetoric which are not based in reason in order to persuade things. Well, one in particular, I'll give you the one example. I think I do mention it in the book. I'd be interested to know what you think about this one. And I'm always terrible at remembering names and who said it. But Miliband was doing quite well. And, basically they threw out, you know, Tory HQ under the Linton Crosby. So he was well known for his Machiavellian techniques and the dead cat strategy, which Boris Johnson had sort of like had publicly spoken in support of, was the idea that you just throw out something outrageous and it changes the subject and it gets people talking about that instead of something else. Also, you can raise doubts. So he threw in this accusation that, you know, what was going to happen was Labour was going to get into bed with the SNP and the nuclear deterrent would go out. And by the way, he stabbed his brother in the back. You know, it was these were classic kind of smears and distraction tactics. And, you know, there is some evidence they worked a bit, right? Now, they didn't work because the electorate is so stupid that everyone believed it. It worked because enough people were, you know, the seeds of doubt were sown, those things were put in, that it affected them. And, you know, you can, I don't know whether you think that's a genuine example of that kind of technique. If not, I'd like to know what you thought was going on, why those accusations were thrown out when they were clearly somewhat spurious. So it does happen, doesn't it? I mean, it's not, you can't just sort of like say, oh, no. In a way, the danger is you're saying, because to say politicians are using these things is to insult the electorate, they never do it. But they do.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Well, what do I think? I don't doubt for a second that, you know, political parties through the centuries have been guilty of skullduggery of different kinds, and I don't actually remember the exact circumstances on which you described. But there certainly have been moments where, I'm sure conservatives have thrown dead cats onto the table, and indeed, you know, were one, without making a party political point, to point to a more recent example of something, it would be the extraordinary accusation put out about Rishi Sunak from the Labour Party, trying to connect him with all kinds of nefarious deeds in absolute violation of any kind of fact. Now, the what is going on there in those cases seems to be an attempt to kind of create a subterranean dog whistle or link. Now, whether it actually affects people, it has this... One of the reasons why people do it, I think, is because the media kind of class gets very angry about it, and then it sustains itself, and therefore you get lots of free publicity from doing it in the way that you weren't anticipating. But the question really makes much difference. I tend to think a series of things that are probably inconsistent. We know that a lot of people make up their minds, on the day itself, or even in the polling booth itself. So there clearly are kind of late deciders. Now, are those late deciders thereby automatically swing voters? No, I don't think so. I think often, you know, they may well have instincts that were shaped by previous experience. And there may be little things in the last few days of an election that break one way or another. There was the Nick Clegg surge in 2010, where it made him do much better than anyone thought as a part of it. And the debates have this effect. But, you know, I suppose what we're as philosophers thinking about is whether or not there's a lot of evidence that the electorate is systematically misinformed. And I tend to think there's relatively little about that. And I think we ought to draw a distinction between different democracies. I mean, a democracy in which you have your local member of parliament is one in which, unless you're living in a big city where there tends to be a lot of turnover of voters, you know, many people will know the MP or know someone knows the MP. And so that does create a kind of accountability and a kind of awareness of, you know, when that person is misleading people, or whether their character is to mislead people. And there's certainly plenty of people in politics who are like that. But you know, there are other countries in which democracies don't have that direct link where people know or know someone who knows the candidate. And in America, the congressional districts are 900,000 people, not 100,000 people or smaller. And so those tend to be ones where you have to give yourself over to, you know, larger scale political communications. And that can create more, I think, more scope for potential deception and misunderstanding.
Well, let me say one thing on that and then move on to the second point of yours I wanted to pick up on. I mean, I think, you know, you're being very sort of generous to the public, which is kind of what we should be. But frankly, and this is something you couldn't directly comment on in your position, but, you know, as a politician like Boris Johnson is such an egregious liar, I would say a liar publicly, a person of no moral backbone and character whatsoever. The fact that still many of his constituents wants to back him shows there's something going on there which is more than just people attending to the evidence and everything.
Without entering a defence, I mean, my views on Boris were set out in my letter of no confidence about this time a year ago. But I do think that it's important not to over-intellectualise this. I mean, when people take decisions about politicians, they're not just taking decisions about their what they say and what they do and whether those are incompatible with each other, because, you know, anyone who thought that would not be able to account for why lots of politicians get elected. They're also making judgments about character, likability, you know, whether they could go out in the pub with them. Now, you might, in some platonic realm, think, well, these people shouldn't have that view. What we really want from politicians is kind of, you know, people who are chosen purely on their ability to answer questions and execute rationally perfect policy. But actually, is that really the right view? And do we not want to put that under some pressure? I would have thought we do.
Well, let me move on to the other point you were talking about, which is that you were saying that politicians do have to think like philosophers because they have to think about trade-offs over things that are incommensurable. And I think that's right. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, politicians at least should be like philosophers. Politics involves very hard choices. You know, I'm actually, you use that term platonic. I'm not remotely platonic about pretty much anything. And I think especially politics is very much a question of muddling through. It's essentially, there's a very, I don't know if you know this, a very short book by Stuart Hampshire, Justice is Conflict. It was his, I think it was his last book. But it was excellent, really. The title says it all, really, which is that, you know, we only need politics and we only need justice because of conflicts of interest, and conflicts of interest which are inevitable, because in any society, what's good for some people is not necessarily going to be good for everyone else. There are win-wins, and there are perhaps fewer zero-sum games than people make out, but there are often these trade-offs. And so one has to do that. The problem here is, of course, that's true, but how often do we get an honest accounting for these trade-offs? How often are we told instead we can have, you know, cake and eat it politics? Or, to use another phrase from our favourite man of the moment. So I think, you know, I would like to think, and this just may be completely naive, I would like a politics in which those trade-offs were discussed more honestly and openly. And I think it's an inability to do that which is problematic. And I think this is perhaps to do with one of the failures or say limitations of democracy, which is that, you know, I know, again, you're sticking up for the electorate here, but most of us are kind of cognitively a bit lazy. We don't want to think about things more than we have to. And a lot of people don't think a great deal about politics. And if one person is sort of saying, well, you know, we can give you this, but you're going to have to pay a price, which is that. And the other person saying, we can give you this and there's no price to pay. You know, it takes a certain amount of effort and, you know, sincerity and demand for accuracy on the part of the electorate to sort of interrogate that and go, actually, you know what, I'm going to pick the person who says there's a downside over the one who says there's no downside. So, you know, it, in a sense, politics in a democratic society is in a bit of the publicity and advertising and marketing game. And I think that does make it hard to be honest about trade-offs, isn't it? I mean, can you think of an example? I'd like to think if you can think of an example in recent politics where any major party has, you know, really made a strong point of the trade-offs, you know, that they've been honest about trade-offs and really followed through on that and tried to persuade in full awareness of that.
A fabulous question. I do think there are moments in politics where people, you know, want to argue for a policy which turns out to be, which they believe in advance is unpopular, or, you know, where, and I mean, I don't want to get too embedded in the current conversation. It's not a topic I'm particularly comfortable with, for reasons you all understand. But I think the conversation about migrants at the moment is a very interesting conversation, because you have an elite discussion which is largely conducted by people who are insulated from many of the concerns that a large section of the normal working population of this country are highly attuned to. And the elite population discussion basically says, you know, we don't, you know, as a result of leaving the EU, you know, that was an act of xenophobia, and then has to work out, well, if it was an act of xenophobia, why is migration higher than it was now than it was before the Brexit vote? And so that's a contradiction which they don't want to have to engage with. And of course, they don't want to have to engage with the fact that many MPs' constituents are deeply worried because they are on housing ladders, because they have trouble getting access to dental care or health care, because of pressure on public services. So there's a requirement for honesty on all sides of this conversation. And, you know, to as it were, just restrict it to the politicians is, I think, a mistake. But I do think that it, you know, you can pick up the point you're making in a slightly different way, and I think accurately, which is to say, when did a politician last say, this is a really difficult question, it's unbelievably complicated, it's hairy and complex, and I can tell you now, we're going to make some mistakes in trying to solve it. But actually, it's really important to proceed, because the ultimate goal is a very valuable one. I mean, I'll give you an example. We've got one at the moment, interestingly, in my department on, which I'm responsible for, the Department of Transport. You know, a lot of people don't like the idea that we would be moving, for reasons of carbon emissions reduction, to electric vehicles. So it becomes a huge set of arguments about how no one can afford a car, electric vehicle, or there's never any charging infrastructure, to which the answer is, hold on a sec, we're at the early stages of a process, and electric vehicles are in many ways a profoundly important change, and they do reduce emissions when you use them over time very effectively, and not just carbon emissions. And yes, the infrastructure is taking time to get it into place, but once it's in place, it'll be there. The same would be true with putting in petrol infrastructure and all the rest of it. So just in other words, we need to be on both sides a bit more grown up about dealing with truths that have, you know, negative short-term consequences, where the big goal is profoundly valuable and worthwhile. And that's a goal that we won't get for another 10 to 15 years or so. But nevertheless, we're taking those decisions now. And I've no doubt that, you know, another party, if it was elected, will do something of the same. So there are moments where, even in with the chop and change of a democracy, you get a consistency of purpose. And there are other moments, health, social care, where you do not get a consistency of purpose, because both sides have found it easier to kind of try to undermine each other, and you don't get the consensus that democracy requires for long-term policy formation. Now, we're a little away from philosophy, but that sense of a willingness to articulate difficult truths and admit that problems are hairy and difficult and complex and may not be easily solved in the short term, I personally think the electorate is crying out for it, but that's not necessarily the view widely held in politics.
Well, that's it. I mean, this is. I mean, are we both sounding sort of naive and hopeful here? I mean, if I think of an example answer to my own question, I'd perhaps suggest, you know, the COVID pandemic. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, I think there was a certain amount of honesty that, you know, we have to move quickly. We're not going to get everything right, and everyone did understand that. But it was unprecedented, and it was non-partisan. It wasn't a party political issue, so people could do that. With most other issues, things become party political. And there's one other obstacle to this, actually, which I wanted to bring up, because, you know, I quote you in the book probably more than once, I believe. And I think you used the phrase, I don't know if I got the phrase from you or you just used the phrase that I got elsewhere, but it's this idea that one of the things that plagues our thinking is term cluster thinking, and you used it, and I use it now, and I don't know if we use it exactly the same way, but by cluster thinking, it's just this idea that people views, certain views, it comes to be assumed that they form a set, and they don't. Okay, so yeah, or they don't have to. And there are examples of one of the worst examples, I think, was climate change, where for a long time it just seemed that climate change was an issue of the left for some reason, and the right did not see it as an issue. And you know, now we can see that's ridiculously naive. It's just a scientific fact, we have to deal with it. But it became associated with kind of like sandal wearing left wing kind of hippies, and the right kind of ignored it. Similarly, there are other cluster thinkings around. I mean, you actually mentioned migration. And there was a certain view, I think, on the left that, you know, there was certain that one cannot sort of even talk about problems of migration, because to acknowledge any problems at all is to be right wing. And I think this sort of cluster thinking is hugely problematic in politics. And it seems that politicians themselves do fall for it. Now, the bit I quoted in the book was you said you thought we were moving beyond this rather boring stage of cluster thinking, which seemed to me to be a rather optimistic comment. Do you stand by that? And what evidence do you have that this is actually true?
Well, I hate to accuse myself of consistency, but you will know, Julian, that I was one of the very few MPs who did not take a public position on Brexit. And one of the reasons was because it was, from a philosophical standpoint, a hopelessly ill-formed and underspecified question, and which affected people in many different ways over a time period which was itself unstated. And therefore, you were going to get was enormous dissatisfaction when people who had, as it were, voted on either side of the debate in one judgment, either did get what they wanted and it turned out to be less than they thought, or didn't get what they wanted and it turned out to be more than, you know, there was an endless possibility for dispute. And I had plenty of constituents talking about cluster thinking who, you know, were good, you know, as it were, paid up believers in the European Union, but who just believed at the end of the day it was becoming a political project that was, you know, was out of control. And I had plenty who were, you know, dyed-in-the-wool conservatives who were perfectly content on the sovereignty issue, but in wanted to have their kids go and do stage and study in Europe. So it turned out to be, in a philosophical sense, really quite a dishonest way to resolve. You know, if ever there was a time where it might have been good to have had some process of pre-digestion or discussion before you put the vote to people, it might have been better to have, that would have been won. But I think in general, what I was trying to suggest was that we were getting away over time from a kind of idea that somehow, if you think social policy is really important, you must be of the left. If you think, I don't think it's ever been true that if you thought environmental policy was important, you had to be of the left. There were plenty of people who were concerned about species and litter and things like that who were of the right. It's only when climate change in terms of carbon became overwhelming that the left took that opportunity of a big state, arguably, to try to align it with themselves. And of course, there are many Tories who are deeply worried about carbon emissions, but don't necessarily think the answer is to spend huge amounts of other people's money doing it. So these are complex questions. And I guess all I was saying was maybe some of these options are being opened up now by the way, in some respects, the big society, my kind of Birkin conservatism is like that, because it's constantly thinking, aren't there what you might call sane reforming ways of solving social problems, which doesn't involve conceding that social problems are somehow automatically the province of one or another political party. So that, I guess, was the context in which we were talking. Why don't we just move on a little bit more philosophically, if we can, and just talk a little bit about what you talk about in the book as P factor. Can you just give us a sense as to what that means and whether you think it's got an application to politics, Julian?
Yes, well, I mean, the P factor, I wanted to call it the phi factor, the Greek letter for the phi, but that was considered too sort of like obscure. So we ended up with the P factor. Well, you know, it's like it's the X factor, the P factor. And I think the P factor is what we call epistemic virtue. It's that kind of, which sincerity and accuracy are two aspects of it. But it's basically that kind of, I think a lot of it is to do with sincerity probably actually, to be honest, is part of the core of it. And how does one put it into practice? And I think two of the things that we really have to do, well, they're one thing in two ways of saying it. It's slow down and pay attention. Because I do think that most bad thinking is a result of, you know, we have the phrase jump into conclusions, and that's what we do. We jump to conclusions. We don't think we jump into conclusions because in our heads, A and B seem logically connected. We think we're just walking over the bridge, right? Whereas actually jumping. So often, if you just slow down and pay attention, you notice that things do not follow from one another, or you notice that there's something suspicious going on. And, you know, part of this is simply just, you know, asking the extra question, checking, is what I've heard what it sounds like? Is this what it seems to be? And you can give so many examples of this. So many news stories come out, and if you just stop for 2 minutes and go, is that right? Is that what it sounds like? And you'll find it's wrong. It's interesting. This is an example which isn't perhaps of the highest political importance, but it is relevant. We're all concerned about food waste, I think. Food waste is a big issue. But when you hear the numbers about food waste, it's quite extraordinary. I discover that a lot of official numbers include in food waste the inedible parts of food. Now, that's just not what most people would expect. If I told you that 10% of food is wasted, you would think that 10% of the food we could be eating is not being eaten. If I was to say, no, that includes bones and shells, you would think, well, that's not what I thought food waste was. So you've always got to dig around in these statistics. And I think that, you know, that's one example, but it's always that slow down and look. It sounds simple, right? That's the thing. Whereas we're often in a hurry, and again, smart people can be in a hurry. I have met lots of very, very clever people, but, you know, actually they want to be right and they want to win. And they're just very, very good at picking up on the arguments that help for that and the evidence that helps for that. And so they're brilliant. They're brilliant in lots of ways, but they're not good thinkers in the way that we would really want a good thinker to be, because their quickness and their wit and their intelligence leads them often to the wrong conclusions because they're just the ones that they want. You must have met a few people like that yourself.
Well, I think that's true, and we can all think of politicians who fit into those categories. So. You know, F.E. Smith, of course, famously kind of great wit, marvellous House of Commons man. Would you want him, as Lord Carrington would say, not necessarily someone you'd want to go into the jungle with? And the other example, I mean, just take an example at random, would be Clement Attlee, not a great jumper to conclusions, not a great kind of rapier wit, but, you know, a rock of solidity in a national government and then in a Labour government. And there is, and that points us to a distinction between kind of parliamentary activity and governing. Mm. And in many ways, what you're describing, I think, are the merits of a good governor rather than the merits of a great parliamentarian. When we think about politics in Parliament, of course, we've touched on a couple of things that are intrinsic to that process: accountability of power to a democratic check and questioning, absolutely essential. Going with that, the crucial importance not just of, as it were, truthful answers in particular cases, but a culture that is normatively oriented towards producing truth and accuracy. Both of those things are absolutely essential. When you get to governing, of course, that preoccupation with truth and accuracy remains. But, of course, you are then automatically having to operate in terms that are more discreet, because you can't make everything public if you want to govern, more oriented towards the collective working out of potentially incommensurable disagreements, as it were, in the changing room, not on the field of play. And that does create challenges. And one of the arguments I often make, and people rarely accept it, but I think it's true, is that the whipping system in British politics is a force for greater honesty and greater cleanliness in politics. No one ever believes this because they think the women's issue is all about, you know, persuading people to vote against their interests and, you know, some poor member of parliament's individual conscience being kind of destroyed by the bullying of the whip's office. In fact, that's not how it works at all. All whipping does is to say, well, hold on a second, you're still on a manifesto, you're supposed to be conservative. We were elected to get a bunch of stuff done. You might want to think about supporting the stuff we've been elected to do. When you get that, then you don't get, and of course, no one wants to credit this because it's so contrary to a rather, I think, a rather naive view of democracy that we sometimes do have in and around politics. No one wants to credit that actually, if the alternative is what the living system was designed to cure, which is factional politics, making, you know, collecting votes by offering people bribes, which is often the way it's done in some other countries one could mention, then whipping looks very good because it's a way of not having pork barrel every time you have a piece of legislation. So paradoxically, something that you thought was bad and possibly a source of dishonesty and evil turns out to be rather helpful and beneficial to the exercise of democratic politics.
Well, that's an incredibly Burkean argument, I think, there, Jesse. It's sort of like, you know, again, you defending something which seems irrational and ridiculous, but actually it turns out it's something that was invented for reasons that we've forgotten and works. I'm not so convinced about that, but rather than focus on that in particular, I suppose one, I'm aware that we're going to have to take some questions in a minute, but I am, one thing that does interest me a lot is, you know, it's very easy to say we want more sort of philosophical thinking, you know, whatever that means in politics. Easy to say that. The point is where, when, how, you know, because it's not realistic to expect, you know, you can't have run day-to-day business or anything as a philosophy seminar, for sure. So when are the right points? Now, there are a few sort of obvious answers to this. I mean, first of all, the most obvious point at which to do this is actually often when parties are in opposition, when they're trying to formulate their policies. So when you're formulating policies, you should be doing that over time. You should be doing that slowly. You should certainly be very philosophical there. There's an argument that on the front line, it's just not really possible. It's naive to expect it. And I know I've spoken to a few people who've been MPs and philosophers, Oliver Letwin, for example. Tony Wright, I definitely count as a philosopher. He's a political theorist in you know, as his official label, but these labels, he was a very philosophical guy. And people, you know, they always say, you know, at the front line of politics, you know, things need to get done. And, you know, often the last people want is the person saying on the one hand this and on the one hand that, or whatever that might be. And so there is a problem about being sort of duly philosophical there. But I'm not so sure. I think that, I mean, I can see sometimes you have to do things quickly so you can't be as thorough as you'd like to. I think that doesn't mean that you should never be sort of like asking all the philosophical questions. And the other thing which I'd like to be optimistic about is that there is a kind of view that whatever you think about what's going on under the bonnet, as it were, no matter how philosophically well thought out the policies are, when it comes to presenting them and persuading people, forget about that. You're just using tools of persuasion, right? Whatever works to get people to believe it. Now, I have this sort of, again, it may seem a naive view, but I do go back to Aristotle on this. Aristotle's view of oratory was that it required three things: logos, pathos, ethos, right? Good, right. So, true. So what is it that makes a persuasive politician? And I think we have examples of this, actually. Is the best persuasive politicians are the people who combine ethos, in other words, they do have good character and they're seen as being a good character. Pathos, they do speak to people's emotions, but also logos, they've got that reason. And I think a lot of the most admirable politicians of recent years, and you know, the people who people generally like and admire, someone like a Barack Obama. Now, what do you think of their politics? Barack Obama, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand. They were people, I think, who did that. They weren't just orators. They weren't just empathizers. They were orators and empathizers, but they were able to also bring in that element of logos. And so you tell, as a frontline politician, am I naive to think that actually we should expect our politicians to be able to speak to our reason as well as our emotions?
Yes. We're going to have to stop in a second. I can see Hannah lurking to come back into the discussion and wind up what's been a fascinating debate. Before she goes, let me make, if I may, a completely controversial but ultimately philosophical point, which you may or may not want to agree with, Julian, which is that we've seen you know, quite a lot of argument about how, you know, poorly performing the economy has been in the wake of the pandemic. A lot of people said, well, this is really about Brexit and shows what a bad idea Brexit was. And I just want to make a very, very philosophical point, which is even if you bracket out the pandemic, no sane person in relation to Brexit thought there wasn't going to be economic dislocation if the UK decided to leave. So the fact that there's economic dislocation if the UK decides to leave is not in and of itself an argument against Brexit. It's something that is implicit in their argument. If we want to see whether Brexit was a good idea or a bad idea, we have to look to a longer term or a different way of thinking about it, because at the moment it's underdetermined. Is that something you have any sympathy with?
Well, I have some sympathy with that, but I also remember there was a bus with a number printed on the side of it, right, which was actually, so you know, the idea that no one was claiming there was an instant win from, some people were claiming that, and a certain number of people believed it, and that number of people who believed it may have been enough. It goes back to what you're saying before, you know, very early on in the conversation. We don't want to claim everyone's stupid and all that kind of stuff, but you only need to fool enough of the people enough of the time. And I think that when it comes to politics, people opportunistically will, I think, sometimes.
We're going to leave as an exercise to the reader whether Julian was changing the subject in their last discussion. But I think that was the moment for me to thank Julian for a fascinating discussion. I've really enjoyed having him put a little bit of the rotisserie treatment on me as a politician. It's been lovely to talk about a few philosophical distinctions with him as a philosopher, and how clever of... Intelligence Squared to have brought this event together, and so thank you to them.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Intelligence Squared. The episode was produced by Hannah Kay, with editing from Tom Hall. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com or tweet us @intelligence2. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our in-person events or peruse over 20 years of the back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.